Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is January 15th, and we have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for a Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding, Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? And also, more recently, Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites, and he has a Substack as well. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Well, we're going to launch today's discussion, I think, on the idea that U.S. equities are at extremes compared to historical norms. And so where is that going? Or how did it arise and where is it going?
Yeah, and you've put together some really interesting statistics that give it an idea of the extremity and all this, the insanity. Do you want to relate some of those statistics?
Yeah. Richard, you know, you and I were speaking before we started recording, and you mentioned the dot-com era, and that was has a lot of parallels in the sense that the extreme valuations at that time were considered rational by the great majority of people, and there was like, you know, kind of a herd instinct. So the growth story now is in the Mag 7 and AI and so on. And so it has that same kind of zeitgeist in that there is a case that to be made for strong growth. And then people say, well, I'm going to join the winners, right? And so you have this concentration in the Mag 7. I think it's something around 37%. So 493 stocks, you know, are kind of left in the dust. So there's that extreme. Then there's extreme of the ownership of stocks in terms of household net worth invested in stocks is at an extreme. The baby boom boomers ownership of stocks is at an extreme. And the percentage of stocks as GDP is at an extreme. So it's kind of across a lot of different metrics, stocks are at extremes. And so the question is this sustainable? Is this a reflection of Make America Great Again, and so on? And you've had many discussions with other guests regarding the move to economic statecraft and national capitalism, which of course are part of the two reasons why some people are justifying these extreme valuations.
Yeah, and you've graciously provided some interesting charts to illustrate the extreme nature of what's happening. Did you want to look at these to discuss? This one is the top 10 representative, almost 40% of the S&PX total value as of the end of last year. So if we look at those lists, right, basically the Mag 7 type of equities.
Right. And we can see that it's far above the dot-com level that we can see on this chart.
Yeah, you've got, and this chart as well, wealth inequality is high and rising.
Yeah, this is kind of a measure of private sector investing in financial assets such as stocks and bonds. And so that's kind of a proxy for wealth inequality because the wealthy own between 85 and 90% of stocks. So as we see that rise, then it's a reflection of rising wealth inequality.
Look at the next one. Total value of all publicly traded stocks divided by GDP ratio. This is very interesting because it looks like it's at an all-time high. I heard figures recently, 170%. It looks even more extreme.
Yeah. Right. And again, it's what's interesting is how it dwarfs the previous extreme in 2000, the dot-com era. So we're at extremes that far outdistance the levels that were reached in the dot-com era. So that should be sobering because, of course, the dot-com bubble, you know, reversed and fell, you know, 80%. This is stock ownership as a percentage of all private assets, you know, real estate and so on. So that's also at a record above 40%.
And the last one, U.S. equities dominate the value of global stocks.
Right. As we all know, the U.S. GDP is maybe 18 to 20% of global GDP, and yet U.S. equities are 60% or even higher, depending on which metric you're using. So yeah, huge concentration of global wealth in U.S. equities. And so Is this justified or, you know, is everyone buying stocks at these levels going to be rewarded by future growth, or is this irrational exuberance?
Yeah, I think the analogy is, it to me, it seems like a similar thing happened back in 2000, you know, with the dot-com boom. You had, instead of the Mag 7, it was the Mag 3, Cisco Systems, Lucent Technologies, and Nortel, basically those three. And what happened was the PEs got extreme and the prices went to extreme levels. And those PEs were actually provided, but it was not over just 1 year or 6 to 9 months. It was over a 20-year period. Like, since then, you know, we have had internet services development, a lot of it, but you know, it's not the impression is it all of that, the summation of that will happen in the first year, right? Over 1 year, PE multiple over the next year. Same thing now, you know, I think we will have generative AI applications going on for the next 20 years, but, you know, it's going to be over the next 20 years, not necessarily only in the next 6 to 9 months, 1 year period. So that PE multiple will be borne out, but over a significant length of time. And that goes along also with a reduction in the price, right? You had Lucent back in 2000 go down to very low levels, like single digits, I think. And the same thing initially from $75 a share. Same thing, I think, will happen with NVIDIA, notwithstanding that you have competition likely from China, right, that will have a NVIDIA-type like company. I think there's one already, SMIC or something. Your thoughts on that analogy?
Yeah, I think, Richard, I have two kind of contexts I'm thinking of. One is that the argument that people, even Mark Andreessen had an article out. Somebody sent me an article that he wrote called "It's Morning in America Again," right? And so this "Make America Great Again." There's a huge sort of consensus building around the idea that the Trump administration is going to recreate at least something like the Reagan Revolution. And that will include a lot of pro-growth policies, drill, baby, drill for energy, reducing regulations, bringing, re-industrializing the U.S. economy or rebuilding some of the infrastructure, and so on and so forth. And so that excitement is positive. But I also wonder if the expectations aren't so high that they're unrealistic.
Meet the cedar owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, there's a lot of questions that still remain unanswered, like where do you have enough skilled labor to do this? Where is the skilled labor? Because if you look out, you know, across the land, a lot of people have gone into different industries, from manufacturing, like into nursing in Ohio and areas where there used to be a lot of manufacturing. So, you know, where are those skills, or how quickly will those skill sets come online, is a big question. I mean, you need to get people educated, right, in science, math, physics, engineering. So that's going to require many years of time. So, you know, it won't happen over the next 3 or 4 months, right? So how is that going to happen? And the other aspect is on the regulatory environment. Is there a conducive regulatory environment to do this? I would venture to say no. There's a lot of unnecessary regulations. There's regulatory capture. We've talked about that a lot in other podcasts. So a lot of these regulations will effectively make it difficult or even prevent a lot of this development from happening. You know, obviously, unless there's some regulatory review process that gets rid of duplicates, you know, optimizes ones that foster innovation and entrepreneurialism, eliminates one that are outdated, right? There's a whole regulatory review process that needs to happen, and that takes time also. So, because it has to go through the legal process as well. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, I think that your point is well taken, Richard, that that there's a time element that we're steering an extremely large ship here. And so I think that's my fear, is the expectation is we can do a U-turn, more like a speedboat, when actually we've got a gigantic liner, you know, kind of a giant container ship here. And it reminds me of the 70s. And I've written a lot about the 70s because I think it's a misunderstood decade. It's generally understood as a stagflation caused by the Fed making policy errors and so on. And there, of course, there's elements of that. But I think what the real story was that the U.S. industry had become uncompetitive with our competitors in terms of the industrial base. And the pollution was so bad that we were destroying our homeland. You know, rivers were catching fire and so on. And so this was not acceptable to the public anymore. And so we had to invest a lot of money and time in basically rebuilding the industrial base. And the payoff was far in the future, to your point, that you know the investment is sucking up money and capital now, but the payoff can be a decade later, or you know, 5, 10, even 20 years later. And so where is the capital going to come from? And so it's if you're going to, you know, I think what happened in the 70s, and I think it's true of any massive investment cycle, is it's competing with consumption, that households and businesses have to like consume less in order to invest more. And so you have a competition for capital. And if the idea is to print enough money to keep the consumer free spending and invest trillions in new infrastructure and industry, then you get inflationary pressures. And then that ends up basically destroying the economy you're trying to improve, right? So I think there's a lot of limits on what any administration can do because of that competition for capital. You know, that somebody has to spend less on consumption in order for there to be more to invest. And so that seems to be a factor that was forgotten. And so stagflation has many causes, and one of them is that you have to invest heavily in the present, but the payoff is far down the road. And so this leads to a stagflationary environment, in my view. And that's part of what happened in the 70s. It was kind of a rebuilding, and that process took a long time, but the payoff was, you know, we started getting the payoff in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s for all the investment that was made in the 70s. So even if this idea of reshoring and make America great again, if that in fact does, you know, manifest, it's going to take the better part of a decade, if history is any guide.
It's going to take time. Yeah, and those are great observations. Where is the capital going to come from? I mean, we've done a number of podcasts in the recent past here on geopolitical risk, like we did the one with Michael Avery of Rabobank. Ira Harris, our co-host frequently on this podcast program, and also Art Berman. And then they have mentioned basically about the shift to economic statecraft. So if you think about that, what is that? That's basically each country, not just the U.S., but each country sort of buying and developing their own internal industrial base, investing in their own industries, in their own people. And if you think about that, as well as observations from Russell Napier, economist Russell Napier, who was also have on this podcast program, he talks about national capitalism, a shift to national capitalism, which is very similar. The idea that there'll be encouragement of more investments at home or in your home country, to help this whole industrial base development. So if you think about that, not just the U.S., it's going to pull a lot of the investable assets that are currently in the U.S. out of the U.S., right? So Japan is a big example, especially with the Japanese yen carry trade. You'll have repatriation of capital back to Japan. It's already been happening and continues to happen. And it's not just Japan, right? It'll be internationally. So this whole level of 70% of all investable assets in the U.S. may come down significantly, maybe more reasonably to what the GDP is of the U.S. relative to the world, you know, 20% or so, plus or minus. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when a lot of people have commented on the sort of retracement of globalism. In other words, globalism was a good thing in terms of lowering prices and increasing profits, but there was a cost that was not recognized in national security, that you know, the United States and other countries became dependent on other countries for essentials, and then you are open to essentially some sort of blackmail. And so that has a national security component as well. And we've seen a lot of commentary on finding essential minerals and so on, that we've been dependent on China, and finding alternative sources and so on. So the national security asset aspect is definitely in play for the first time in decades. And I think, to your point about statecraft, there's a shuffling, pardon me, there's a shuffling of competition, of alliances and frenemies, right? Like, we're both competitors and friends with a lot of different countries, and everybody is playing that same game, that you want to keep trade and capital flows open, But you also have to look out for your interests first and foremost. And so that's going to change the landscape of capital flows as well, to your point of capital returning home as national economies start focusing on strengthening their own economies by sacrificing globalization and trade.
And so we always look to positive ideas on, how can this be addressed, or how can the risk be mitigated, or, what can we do positively about this trend? You've mentioned the likely trend of a stagflationary environment. How can consumers, investors, and also at the personal level deal with this? And you've written a lot of books on how to be more independent and, enhancing your skills, decentralized solutions with the community. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think, if we look again at periods like the 70s, where it wasn't the Great Depression, it was just it was a shift in the nature of the of production and consumption and globalization and so on. And so if we're in this period where there's a lot of dynamics swirling around and competing with each other, then and all these extremes are going to very likely return to the mean, just statistically, then, obviously you want to stay away from things that are at extreme levels. And you want to find things that are either deep or that you control, right? So in terms of where are you going to put your money, if you can do something in your own house that reduces your cost or creates energy or an income flow that you control, that seems to me to be a better, safer bet than sort of gambling that that high growth is going to continue in the exact same sectors. That bet did not pay off in 2000 for the reasons that you explained. So, and people seem to kind of rely on sort of these centralized systems to do everything for them. And so where you and I and many other people are more of the mind that, well, if you want to invest in infrastructure rather than invest in a monopoly company, you might be better off investing in your own personal infrastructure, like, solar panels and heat pumps and so on. And the more that you control, it seems to me, then you're more likely to get a payoff, and it's less of a gamble because it's like it's part of your actual day-to-day life. So that's kind of my general thinking. It's we can expect reversion to the mean, then act accordingly.
Yeah, those are great points, observations, and advice. And also to add that from an investment, the 1970s, a lot of the assets generally around the theme of hard assets seem to have made sense during that time, in terms of commodities or energy, precious metals, things that can hold some value. So that's, something to consider from an investment ideas perspective.
Absolutely. So the essentials of energy, food, transportation. Yeah, these will always have value. And if there's scarcities, then of course the value will rise accordingly.
Yeah. Great. It's been an interesting, insightful discussion. Your final thoughts, and also how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work? Where can they go?
Yeah, please visit me at Charles Hugh Smith at Substack.com. So, and thank you very much for the opportunity, Richard, to talk about extremes. And it's going to be a very interesting decade, I think, going forward.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Thank you so much, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.